I think we're going to go ahead and begin. So first of all, let me just say thank you all so much. It is a tremendous honor to be with you all and to be invited to participate in today's discussions. Do not come from the Wesleyan Church. I am a Christian, but I happen to work at Southern New Hampshire University. Do want to be very clear that there's no Bible verse in any of this. This is not... doesn't have any kind of particular orientation, but I think is some good kind of practical business thinking that we apply at the university, at Southern New Hampshire University, which I'll talk about briefly, and I hope will be of value to you. I do have to say, just kind of sitting in on that session and just kind of thinking about the way in which you are able to integrate mission and vision and strategy with kind of spiritual fulfillment, right? And all of that, I think, just creates a very, very robust platform for this kind of thinking. Let me just say very briefly, so you know who I am. I lead the innovation and strategy arm of Southern New Hampshire University. We are based, obviously, in New Hampshire. I live in the Boston area. We currently serve 135,000 plus learners across several different learning platforms and modalities all around the country and increasingly in different parts of the world, including refugee education programs and some kind of emerging global programs. I love the work I do. I believe that it is critical. Not just for our university, but for our world. I think that we have real challenges ahead of us. And so I spend my time really thinking about the future of higher education. This is literally all I do, and it's actually all I know about. So if you ask me about something else, I don't know about those things. I only know about this stuff. But do kind of bring an interesting background. I actually did a seminary degree many years ago from a Calvinist seminary, but sorry about that. Not a Calvinist, but was there and then kind of moved into education. And then now I'm currently doing some doctoral work at Vanderbilt University studying organizational change strategies. So all of that to say, I think this is a really important topic. And I think it's one that that all of us should be having because of this. Now, hear me on this. These are not assumptions. These are not ideas. These are facts. And we could debate those facts, I'm sure, and I'm sure we could have different discussions about it. But at the end of the day, this is what we know, and I think that, you know, I've done this for a while, read a lot of books. I hire a lot of really smart people to help us as a university really think about what we do. I think this is pretty close. If I was to think about what that future looks like, lifelong learning is more than just a buzzword. It's more than just something your continuing education people occasionally bring up at a board meeting. It is truly a mandate for higher education. For us to think that education starts at 18 and ends at 24, or that includes some sort of graduate study, is irrelevant. This is not the way our market and our environment is structured anymore. People come in and out of learning in different formats, and we have to be prepared to meet our learners where they are with what they need. Learning's everywhere. You compete with YouTube a lot more than you think you do. You compete with Wikipedia. You compete with new and fledgling learning models such as boot camps and online learning formats. You probably compete with SNHU. Sorry. There's a lot out there. It's a very crowded market. It's a very, very crowded space. You cannot change that. So, I mean, and this is where I have to be a little controversial because this is kind of my job. Like, you're not going to change the fact that your students use YouTube in the classroom. It is never going to change. In fact, it is going to get worse. Right? So you have to continue to think about ways to evolve the delivery model to accommodate for these tools. Learning's digital. It's everywhere. Digital learning, by the way, is not the same thing as online learning. Online learning refers to a modality. Digital learning refers to a strategy or a structure of weaving together various technologies to deliver scaled learning experiences. Learning is practical. Everyone loves to debate this one. I put this one up and people yell at me. I was at a liberal arts conference a few weeks ago and was presenting on this and they all lost their minds. At the end of the day, it can be deep. It can be rigorous. You can read Aristotle. You can do all these really interesting things. But at the end of the day, what we do has to be practical. It has to meet the needs of our learners. It has to give them the skills and competencies and experiences that they need to be successful in their context and in their world. That's practical to me. I think that naturally means that we really need to align what we do to the workforce. Work is an incredibly important part of our lives. If I was wearing a different hat, I do a lot of work and a lot of research and did my graduate study actually in the theology and philosophy of work. So I think a lot about workplace ministry. I think a lot about kind of what it means to engage in the workplace, what it means, the value of work, the kind of kingdom calling of work. This is all work that I think is incredibly important. I also think you're in a very prized position right now to really claim that narrative in ways that that few types of organizations and schools can do. And it's personalized. Personalized does not equal individualized. It doesn't mean that we're sort of individualizing the experience. It means we're meeting our learners where they are, and we're equipping them with the skills and competencies that they need to be successful. Okay, so again, these are facts. These are not things that, at least at SNHU, we sit around and debate. They are things that we operationalize around. And one of the ways in which we do that is through what we call futurist forecasting and strategic foresight. And I'll show you kind of more what that means in a second. But we have to do this because we have a lot of issues ahead of us, right? So these are some categories. These are at least the things that keep me up at night, and I think should keep anyone who cares about higher education up at night. Changes in consumer behaviors. Your students are demanding things today that our institutions are not always equipped to deliver on. Economic conditions, coming recession, not coming recession. These are all things we have to think about. We have to be very mindful of. They have to inform our strategy and our thinking. Abundance of new technology. So many tools and technologies out there available to you. Evolving ecosystems. So to even think, for example, that digital learning simply means a learning management system, it's just not true, right? So there's learning ecosystems sort of all around us. We have to stitch those together. We've got to be engaged in that. We've got to really make sure that we're using those. Again, not technology for technology's sake. Technology so we can scale our programs to the level of demand. Does that make sense? We have to be able to scale. A new value proposition. Higher education, the value proposition of higher education, I think it's changing a lot. I think it used to be a certain thing, and then it kind of morphed into something else. I'm not entirely sure all of what that is. I think it's probably several value propositions. But I think that the value that you bring to your students, to communities, to the world, I think it's changing a bit. And I think that we have to really think about, you know, kind of what that means, what that looks like. Political stability, so we think a lot about this at SNHU. We really have to monitor the policy environment, the world in which we're in. All of this has a direct impact on the work that we do. Demography and, of course, new competition. Having a great breakfast this morning, sort of talking about this notion of, you know, online education, right? So online education in 2008. So I used to be a market analyst at a company called Edge Ventures, and so I have been studying online learning forever. And I can tell you, in 2008, online learning was a real boom market. It was growing. Lots of schools were kind of getting into the game. It was a fairly novel modality. It allowed a lot of institutions to scale up very quickly. That quickly, around 2012, 2013, became a very crowded market. Also a very kind of convoluted market. Uneven value proposition, hard to determine what school did what. It is also a highly regionalized market. So most institutions, I led a big study at Edge Ventures years ago that found that 95% of institutions with large online programs or even medium-sized online programs were only attracting students from about 150 square mile radius of where they were located. So it's not as if you're located in Michigan and all of a sudden you're attracting students from Seattle, right? This is not the way the market works. So again, we have to kind of think about this. Also the effect of new competition. So what do we do about this at SNHU? Think a lot about the future. So I want you to just do a quick exercise. We're not going to share anything, but we are going to get up here in a little bit and do an exercise if that's okay with you. So I want you to imagine, close your eyes for a second. So this is 2019. So 10 years from now, 2029. How old are you? They don't think about that, right? It's depressing. If you have kids, how old are your kids? So I have a 5-year-old and a 2-year-old. So my 5-year-old is going to be 15 years old. Think about your institution or whatever you represent. Like, what does that place look like 10 years from now? Right? What does that world look like? Imagine yourself going grocery shopping. What's that experience like? This is 10 years from now. Okay? Any ideas, by the way? Any thoughts? Yeah, it's a good question. Maybe it's coming from drone delivery. Yeah. I'm okay with that, actually. I'm fine with that. It's great, right? What does your world look like? I'm asking, by the way. This is where you attack me with insights. Traffic, yeah. I live in Boston. Never seem to fix that problem. So oftentimes when we do this, I think we often get these images of kind of this technocratic world, technology everywhere. It usually kind of looks different. The bottom line is that the future actually probably won't look that much different, at least 10 years from now. But when I say that, I think you probably start thinking this, right? So you looked at the agenda and you thought, oh my goodness, who is this person and what is he about to come talk to us about? So to be clear, this is not what we're talking about and this is not something that we really think about. Science fiction, I think, of course, can give us a lot of interesting insights into what that future may look like. And actually, go back and watch shows like The Jetsons, and they're actually pretty spot on. And I think you can learn a lot. But this is really not what we're doing, okay? So I'm not going to play clips from The Matrix or anything like that. Really, what we're just talking about is good old-fashioned business strategy and tools that we use to inform our business at the university. Okay, so why focus on the future? First of all, and we talk about this a lot, it kind of allows us to push past our cognitive anchoring in the past. A lot of research would suggest human beings are wired to think about the past. We're often wired to gravitate toward what's familiar to us. And psychologists would also say that we often gravitate towards things that were actually painful to us. And I'm not going to go too far down this route, but sometimes when people are afraid of like fighting for the future of higher education and this institution is going in the wrong direction, sometimes that actually comes from a place of pain. And it comes from a place of actually you're projecting all of these other things you have on this institution, and we'll talk about that yet. But you have to really kind of think about that, right? You got to think about, like, we're afraid of the future because the future is very uncertain. It allows you to push past biases. So when you think about the future, here's the good news about futurist thinking. No one in here knows the future. So we're like leveling the playing field, right? It allows you to look past an expected future. So you can often say, for example, and I'm privy to a lot of these discussions both at our university and through the work I do, you know, people are going to say, this institution's just in a world of trouble, and it just, if we don't do this, it's the whole thing's going to fail. You don't actually know that, right? Or someone to say, I think we're in a great shot. I think 10 years from now, we're going to be amazing, and it's going to be wonderful. You don't actually know that. Right? No one actually knows that. But there are ways to actually plan for that and to sort of think meaningfully about that. It allows you to imagine alternative realities. So believe it or not, your institution probably has four possible futures. You could either completely transform yourself, do something entirely new. You could stay the course. You could just keep kind of fulfilling your strategy. You could go into utter decline and ruin. Or you could just do nothing. You could just maintain the status quo. Right? So if you think about this, there are actually only four possibilities. So once you think about that, we start to then imagine, well, then how would you go back and kind of reverse engineer your thinking and your strategy around those different possibilities? Does this make sense so far? And it helps us to be part of shaping the future. This is a little bit cliche, but if you don't shape your future, somebody else will. If you don't shape the future of your institution, someone else is going to shape the future of your institution. In fact, there are lots of forces out there that are already doing that. You can choose to lean in and be part of that, or you can choose to ignore it. But there are some real kind of fundamental shifts happening, big, you know, kind of systematic, you know, scaled challenges that are coming for higher education. It's very likely, for example, that Amazon will get into the education business in some capacity in the next 5 years. They follow the same playbook with retail. Now they're moving into healthcare. If you recently followed their recent joint venture with Berkshire Hathaway and J.P. Morgan. We do a lot of work. So I run a team of research associates and kind of internal consultants for the university. We've been tracking this quite a bit. Three of Amazon's recent hires that had education in the title were delivery experts. They were content people. They were not policy people. They were not university presidents who just kind of wanted to dabble in what it would look. They were actual people that know how to develop content. They were typically people, the three people that they hired came from the world of kind of machine learning and artificial intelligence and the incorporation of that into delivery of education. So they're doing something. What it is, I don't fully know. I was there a few months ago and I tried to like squeeze into things, but they wouldn't let me in. It's a big building. But we have to be part of that. Okay, so this is what we mean, by the way, by strategic foresight. This is a very important model. So if you could kind of, I know, take a picture. I'm happy to send this to you. Happy to talk with you further about this. Okay, so let me just show you what I mean here. Okay, so first of all, whether you realize it or not, every day from where you sit, you are encountering trends, signals, stabilities, and forces. And I won't go through what each of these mean. Trends, things that are just happening, right? People are now using smartphones to learn. That's a trend, right? You encounter signals. Okay, and we're going to talk about signals here in a moment. The fact that people are using smartphones to learn, there's something there, right? That's not just something that happens. That's a signal of some shift, something that's changing. You encounter stabilities. These are opportunities for you to ignore a lot of those things and pursue some sort of stability, right? That's that cognitive anchoring in the past kind of thing, right? You can say, for example, well, that's interesting. Well, we could also just see we have a strategic plan and we have faculty and we have buildings. And so these are like our stabilities, right? You encounter those, right? And those are often in friction. And then you encounter forces, big, systematic, kind of episodic forces, things that come at you, big, kind of mega trends. I mean, these are things from, you know, global poverty to, you know, climate change to political instability to, you know, these are big, big things that are actually reshaping the world around us. Okay? Make sense so far? So now you gotta figure out what to do with that. So there's three ways in which organizations deal with that. First of all, they just manage their day to day, right? So you still gotta get up, gotta go to the office, you send emails, you have meetings, you keep the lights on. That's one approach that can allow you to kind of stave off some of these challenges, is you just keep the ship running, as it were. Another strategy, and businesses have employed this for many, many years, but it really actually did not become a thing until about the 1980s, with the formation of companies like McKinsey and Bain and Boston Consulting Group, is something called strategic planning. So we're actually going to plan. We're actually going to develop a strategic plan. I'm sure every institution here has a strategic plan. What that does is it allows you to think a little bit further out. So you notice the continuums here, right? So strategic plan is not, you're not just writing about things in the day to day. You're writing about, like, here's our plan. Like, you know, we're going to think about 5 years out. We're going to have these goals. This is probably what we think the university is going to look like. This is what we're striving towards. And when you do a strategic plan, you also start to dabble in uncertainty, right? Because, as I said before, you actually don't know what your institution is going to look like 5 years from now. You're guessing. You're making an informed guess, but you're starting to move into the realm of the possible or the impossible. Make sense so far? Okay, so what I'm talking about today is kind of a third layer for your institutional strategy, and it's what we call foresight strategy. So in my job every day, I do not do strategic planning. I'm not actually that good at strategic planning. I'm good at foresight because foresight is a little squishier. It deals with things that are a lot less certain, but it also deals with things that are increasingly more important because of the things we were talking about before. So far, so good? Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you today a couple of ways to do foresight, all right? Because, again, you have to be able to leave here with something kind of in your hands, like, okay, you know, again, we're not just watching clips from The Matrix and talking about how higher education is doomed. No, we're going to do something about this, guys. Like, there are things that you can do tomorrow. They're not hard, and they're things that you can kind of incorporate in your meetings and your practices, and I want to show you. All right, so first of all, strategic foresight. Everyone likes a good definition. I'm back in grad school now, so I have to remember this. Sometimes I just keep going, but we got to define our terms and all this kind of stuff. So it's this idea of kind of turning facts about the present into clear and actionable views of the future. And what that means is that we have to be able to think, we have to do a lot of what we call sense making, kind of understanding the world in which we're living in, and try to turn what we know into some actionable view of the future. I'm going to show you what that means here in a bit. This is a mindset. So really, I would recommend you not form a foresight committee for your university. I would recommend that you do foresight all over the university. Does that make sense? This is not an opportunity to form another committee. Sorry. I mean, university administrators love a good committee. We do too, but we don't do that. So my unit at the university, we're actually an operational unit. We're a separate unit, non-revenue generating unit for the university. That is really designed to embed foresight strategy and future strategy across the whole university. Does that make sense? But we're not a committee. We're actually tasked with doing this work. Okay, so a few things you have to remember, and I just mentioned this to you before. The future doesn't exist. So this means no one here is an expert. You can remember this next time you're in a meeting and someone starts talking about the future. Well, that's actually not true. You don't know what the future is, right? There are lots of different possible futures, and so when you do foresight, you end up operating in what we call alternative realities, as I said before. Just, you know, two or three possibilities for the future. And the reason you do that is so you're not surprised, right? So again, we do this work so that we know. So SNHU is obviously operating at scale. We're very large. We are a nonprofit institution, which means that we are highly mission-driven, and which means also that we do not have access to private equity and private capital the way the for-profit sector does, right? So in the event that there was a massive resurgence of the for-profit sector, we would actually be in a lot of trouble. We're ready for that. Does that make sense? I've thought about that possibility. I actually have a strategy. So if and when the for-profit sector really takes off again, we are ready for that. We know exactly what we're going to do. And if it doesn't, we also know what we're going to do. Does that make sense? Just kind of alternative futures and realities. Okay, this is all very grounded in literature. Again, I like to be very clear. This is not The Matrix. This is just good old-fashioned business strategy. A lot of it comes from this book, Thinking About the Future. If you do not own this book, you should purchase it tonight, and you should read it on your Kindle. And then once you have a print copy on your desk when you return, you should read the entire thing. Talks kind of about this notion of foresight really being a systematic process that allows you to lay out some of those differences and dive into uncertainty, because, again, uncertainty is becoming increasingly the norm. What I like about this book is it also talks about how this process is really designed to be very persuasive, but also very accessible. Cannot stress enough. This is an inclusive process. One of the things that I dislike about strategic planning in higher education is that it's typically done in a smoke-filled room. Maybe you guys don't smoke. I don't smoke anymore. But you know what I mean. Like, it's sort of this thing where, right, it's like, you know, the administrators kind of hunker down with some consultant, and they come up with a strategic plan, and then they drop it on everyone's lap. Well, there's a reason why 90% of those plans are never fulfilled, because you never included people in the process, right? So foresight, again, is design. It's not a committee. It's something that's designed to be very persuasive, but it's also something that's designed to be very accessible. Okay, so here's what we're going to do. Are we ready to do something? You're going to have to stand up. I know some of you hate this, but you're going to have to do it anyway. All right, we are going to literally stand up, and we're going to make a line from this end of the room to this end of the room. And you need to make a straight line. There's no bunching allowed. So make a line, and then I will give you instructions. Like a diagonal line, like a big diagonal line, and I know this is a lot of people in here, but we'll, and we'll bunch up a little bit because of our room constraints. All right, so this is the exercise. Believe it or not, focusing on the future is as much a mental as it is a physical exercise. And this is a thing, this is a tool, this is an exercise that you can use in your next meeting to really kind of get people up, get the blood flowing. It also forces people to take a stand. Ooh. I know some of you are like, no, okay, sit down, no taking stands. So you are standing. Okay, so here is the prompt. In the next 10 years, I see the world getting better or getting worse. You're going to line up along a continuum. If you see the world getting better, you gravitate towards this side. If you see the world getting worse, you gravitate towards this side. The trick is you have to line up as much as possible, okay? So I don't like the murky middle, like, it depends. No, you got to make a decision here. Where do you fall along that spectrum? You ready? Go. You'll notice the optimists are over here making stick figures, having a good time. World's great. Okay, so obviously we're not going to go down and have everyone speak, but first of all, just to recognize, you are actually lined up right now, and you're taking a stand. You are showing your colleagues what you actually think. We don't do this very well, at least in our organization, right? Okay, so let's start down here with the doomsday scenario. So, I knew you looked out of place. I don't know. Okay. So presumably down here, you believe the world is getting worse. Why? What's happening? Yep. Yep. So if you remember back future forces, remember I talked about that? Inputs to the process? So you're, at least what you've shared here, obviously you have a lot of thought, So you're like real mindful of those future forces, and you have a kind of a negative view on them. They're scary. They seem dismal. They seem dark. Okay, others, sort of down here. Who else?
Secularism with decreased emphasis on spirituality, Christianity primarily.
Yep.
And that sort of thing.
Yeah, so I mean, so the Christian narrative, the kind of world, the... Christ and culture, all these different paradigms that seem to be coming in, seem to be suggesting that secularization could be a real threat, could be a real threat to your institution. We're all kind of aware of that, right? Okay, and then that can, so again, that can kind of easily put you into a certain mindset. It's not necessarily right or wrong, it's just that kind of puts you in a mindset. I'm attuned to that. That bothers me. I turn on the news and I am bothered by that. And then I walk into a strategic planning meeting and that is on my mind. Does that make sense? So again, inputs to the process, right? So that's like a force. That's almost a signal. There's a signal. I'm seeing something out there. It doesn't seem right. Okay, someone, here's the middle. The it depends crowd. That's usually where I am.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So I'm trying to figure it out. Okay, real quick. So if you all were writing a strategic plan right now, you'd actually come at it from very different perspectives. Keep that in mind. And again, I'm not trying to reduce us to cat, but you see where I'm coming from, right? So when we walk in the room, we have to know this, right? All right, let's go all the way down here to the optimists. What are your thoughts?
We can make the difference. I mean, we're writing the future. We can do it. So okay. It's a matter of putting the facts in place and say, let's make transformation.
Yep. Okay. Others?
Every year, our institution is turning out hundreds and thousands of disciple makers who know the truth.
Okay.
And then we're making other disciples. That has to have a positive impact on what's going to happen.
Okay. So, again, we are the foresight committee. You're never going to form a committee, but remember, we're the foresight people. We're the ones who are kind of attuned to this. You're the leaders, kind of head of the institution. If we were to steer the course of an organization right now, even just based on this one input, we would all be in very different places. You have to identify this. We have to orient towards the future. Otherwise, you will get nowhere with this. It's a very simple exercise. Okay, one more prompt. Now you're going to line up. It's a little bit more personal. I am able to personally affect the future versus I am not able to affect the future. So I feel like I have control over the future versus I feel like I have no control. Does that make sense? So no control down here. Control here. If you need to change, change. Oh, wow. So I did this exercise, literally, I did this exercise a couple weeks ago, and the group went in the opposite direction. I was like, control, and they were like, nope, all the way down to the end. So this is good. All right. So you feel like you got some control. Okay, so let's try to tease out some of the polarities here. So let's start down here.
Yeah, just being part of this.
Yeah.
We have it's a humbling responsibility.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow, yeah, that's good. Others? Let's go down here. Kind of on the fence on the control. Who is like really on the fence? Like who really should be standing over there? Because I know someone in here is like, eh.
We don't think we should be able to, if we're going to be able to affect the future, we probably shouldn't be on board.
Yeah. That's true. That's true. So you are board members. You've selected into that.
This way, anybody can move that way.
Yep. And absolutely, now let me challenge that in a good way for a second. So you are the board, but you're also tasked with governing people that may not agree with that, right? So they feel like they don't have control, right? So how do you kind of navigate that? We call that a polarity, right? So we have control. So I face this a little bit in the institution in that what we do for innovation management at the university, it's sometimes seen as our colleagues as being a little bit on high. You have a big budget and you can do this kind of stuff. And we have a lot of people that say, well, I'm just not part of that, right? It's a real problem, right? So I spend a lot of my time, I tell my team all the time, you have to spend time in the business. You've got to let, so my team, we listen to advising calls. If there's an opportunity to listen to what students are going through, you got to spend time out there, right? It's critical, right? So this happens, right? So again, we have to think about that. So, you know, kind of in a position of control, right? Now, I would also venture to guess, and we won't ask this, but even to that point, I think even what it means to be on a board, though, is sometimes a little shaky. Like, what is our role? What is our responsibility, right? Because I also think that's kind of changing. At least I've observed that at SNHU and other universities I've been a part of. You're like, what are we supposed to be doing here? Exactly. Does that make sense? Like, what is our job? And what does this university need? And is what this university needs? So I sit on a couple of boards, and there's times where I kind of wonder, like, sure, they need me. Or actually, I think they really need me. Or they need someone like me. Or they need someone, right? So again, I think all of this kind of prompts that discussion about what that means. Does that make sense? So again, real quick, I know we don't have a ton of time, but simple exercise, right? Good, gets people up, gets people on their feet, allows people to think. But more importantly, you have to take a stand on this kind of stuff, right? Okay, have a seat. Yeah, it's fun, isn't it? Yeah. So while you're sitting, and again, I'm maximizing all my time, there are two other questions. There's actually dozens of questions that you can do. Another question, and I wasn't going to ask this before, also just recognizing you come from different institutions, and I am still somewhat of an outsider, so I don't want to put you in an awkward position. In the next 10 years, I see my institution's world getting better or getting worse. This is really where the rubber meets the road, right? So again, like, okay, so we're on the institutional planning committee. We got to decide what we're going to do. Rather than just getting right down to tactics, let's ask that question. But more importantly, let's stand up out of our chairs from behind our laptops and actually take a stand on what we think, right? I think the institution's getting better. Why? Because I can tell, we got this, we got this. Or, you know, I think the institution's getting worse. Well, why? Because here, you know, kind of here's the evidence. Another question you can ask, in my current position, I feel empowered versus disempowered. Make sense? That's kind of a good management. I do this sometimes with my team, right? Like, you know, so kind of working on this. Do you feel like you've got the power to make that call, or that you have the, or do you feel kind of disempowered? This is a really, really important kind of tactic and strategy. Make sense so far? Thoughts or comments on this? Yeah, yeah. And that's a strategy, right? So I think, you know, what that does. So one of the things we do a lot at SNHU, it's a really good strategy. We work with an organization called the Center for Creative Leadership in North Carolina, but they talk a lot about, just awesome. I mean, just like amazing, amazing exercise. If you have the chance to bring your team down, it is worth every dime. They're not paying me to say that, by the way. They're good people. We talk about the center of gravity. Center of gravity analysis. Really good exercise to go through. You could really worry about a bunch of things that actually have very little weight on your institution, honestly. Like, we could really worry about this political issue or this thing that happened on campus, and at the end of the day, that actually does not have a lot of gravity. It is here today and gone tomorrow. You know, I have a friend who works for college up in the Boston area, and you know, they're in trouble financially, and it's kind of the usual narrative. The center of gravity for that institution right now is the CFO role. The chief financial officer has an enormous task ahead of him. Does that make sense? And so if I'm worrying about anything, it's that CFO. I gotta make sure he gets what he needs, right? Because he's making some tough calls right now, and you know, he's building the models, and that's kind of where we need to focus our efforts right now. Now that's going to change. So right now at SNHU, the CFO role is really not the center of gravity. The center of gravity is kind of our operational unit, because we have a hard time. We're very good at operationalizing things, but we can't always sustain them. So you kind of have to know the institution and know where that center of gravity is. Did you have a question or comment, sir? Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Yep. Yeah, lots of possibilities, right? I mean, and again, and the idea here is, chance to get people out of their seats, get people taking a stand, get people thinking out loud about these things. Okay, good. So I'm going to introduce you to a second strategy. I know we only have a little bit of time. We have till what, 3:45? So we're going to do a whole separate thing. Okay, so let's say you've kind of done this, you're orienting towards the future, you're getting people to think. I now want to introduce you to a second strategy that we generally refer to as combinatorial forecasting. Use that in your next meeting. You'll sound really, really smart. Basically, all combinatorial forecasting is analyzing signals and coming up with hypotheses around what those signals might be telling you about some new future possibility. Okay, I'm going to show you what that means. Then we're going to do a little signals analysis here in a second. Okay, let me just set the stage here for a little bit. So these are some results from a research document that was produced in 1971 by Palo Alto-based, then New York-based Institute for the Future. They were working with the RAND Corporation on some kind of, you know, big think foresight and futures, largely around kind of the future of retail and the future of commerce. And this is what they determined in 1971. So they predicted that there will be shopping transactions that occur using some sort of cataloged type format. They weren't really sure what, of course. So obviously they did not know Amazon and Zappos. They just said in the future, this is 1971, in the future there's going to be these kind of scaled shopping transactions. They predicted the rise of person-to-person work. People being paid to work at home. It's a very novel concept at this time. So they're looking at this and they're saying, we're seeing some signals and some trends that suggest there may come a time when people actually work from their home. So they anticipated a future where there was some sort of modality that would play and plays, that plays and movies could be delivered from some sort of video library. Now, that started as the video store, right, that morphed into Netflix and sort of online platforms. But this was an interesting idea at the time. Okay, so what does this look like? So when you do this work, and this is a lot of text, I'll just kind of explain this to you. The first thing that you are always doing is you're looking for what we call hits. A hit is something that you notice when you surround, when you analyze or you scan your surroundings for evidence of some future happening. Okay, so just kind of embrace that language a little bit. You're looking for a hit. You're looking for something that makes you go, ooh, that's, there's more to that than just that, right? There's more of a there than what I think. We might often call these signals. So a signal is often a small or kind of local innovation. With the potential to affect other localities and topics. So it's something that might seem very small. When I do this, I often say you have to make friends with the fringe. These are like odd things, like things that don't even seem, like why are you talking about that, right? Well, there's something there, right? There's a reason why this is happening. What's, you know, the big Comic-Con thing that goes there? There's a reason why people put on these crazy costumes and they gather for like weeks at a time. Burning Man is another example. This really, I mean, I've never gone anything like that, but like you go out to the desert and they like have these, and then they live in tents and they burn a big, what is that, right? Well, actually there's something there. Like top Silicon Valley execs do this every year. People that are shaping the product roadmaps and the culture around us actually do this. So there's clearly something there. There's something to Burning Man that I think we need to better understand. This can be something happening today that you instinctively feel will move a driver in a particular direction. Okay? Make sense so far? Again, smaller local innovations, so don't think big things. Okay? These are like small things, but they can also sometimes be, you know, recent happenings. So like startup businesses could be an example, right? Upwork is an example. Remember what Upwork is? Upwork is a signal, in my opinion. Upwork is creating a mobile app to allow people to find jobs through their smartphone without going to an employment agency. That's a signal. Okay, so what can a signal be? A signal can be a product. It can be a service. It can be a technology, or it can be a policy. Like a government policy. Okay, so what I want you to do, just off the top of your head, is I want you to think of something that you think might be a signal. You can jot it down. I'm going to show you a bunch of signals here in a moment, but start thinking about this, right? Now, this is hard. This is kind of where the rubber starts to meet the road, right? All right, so what are those signals, right? Like, let me take all this out of the ethereal and kind of ground this in. Okay, I am seeing these five things, and they just sort of make me pause. Okay, there's something there. All right, let me show you a couple of signals. These are kind of higher ed related. So New York adopts free tuition. Someone was saying before other state. I mean, so your state adopts free tuition, free community college. So community college presumably is going to be free. That's a signal. That is something. I don't fully know what to do with that. I could form all kinds of hypotheses about what this means, but before I do that, I just need to flag that that is a thing that is happening. There are now earbuds that can translate languages in real time. So I could have these earbuds in. I could go to Spain. Someone could be speaking Spanish. I don't speak Spanish, but it translates. Okay? So, by the way, it's a pretty immense possibility for education, right? These are technologies that are happening now. Twitch, you know what Twitch is? Okay, so Twitch, what is Twitch? Just come and give us a quick explanation. Yeah, so Twitch is a platform for gamers. It's really what you would refer to as a social learning platform, actually, if you really sort of want to apply an educational lens to it. It kind of looks and feels like a learning management system, but it's very participatory. It's a platform for engagement. It's also a way that people make a lot of money. So gamers actually get paid to play games and have other people watch to learn how to, you know, beat, you know, certain, you know, they sell cheat codes and all this kind of stuff. My boss, his son, his math tutor, he met over Twitch. So guy is doing kind of game, and so basically the rule is, I will show you how to play this game for 15 minutes, and then we're going to talk about math for 15 minutes. And then we're going to play the game for 15 minutes. So this is happening, guy. I mean, this is very mainstream. This isn't a fringe type of thing. This is a very kind of mainstream. Amazon bought Twitch 2 years ago. I think that it has a lot of potential to really change the way teaching and learning happens, right? As I had mentioned before, kind of the changes in consumer demand and consumer behavior. So this is actually what your students are accustomed to. Right? So what happens is I'm on Twitch, and we call this the omni-channel consumer. It's a good term, kind of something to think about. So I actually consume things across multiple platforms, usually technological in nature. And then lo and behold, I encounter the registrar's office. And I have to fill out a paper form. Now, we might go, oh, well, of course you're... Well, no, but that's actually a novel thing. Sorry. That's not common anymore, right? And beyond that, it actually is an inhibitor to scale. You know, a lot of technology can do that kind of stuff, right? It's actually keeping you from scaling, right? So, you know, a lot of times institutes say, well, we really want to grow, so we're going to do enrollment management. You could also just get your people some spreadsheets, right? You could just literally, like, stop using the paper forms and get people more scalable technology, right? So there's a lot of strategies to kind of employ, right? But the bottom line is, this is what your learners do. It's not even what they expect, it's what they know, right? This is what learning looks like. This is kind of how it's happening. Now, again, it's happening outside of the bounds of conventional education, but it is happening nonetheless. So you got to decide kind of what are you going to do about that, right? So Twitch is a signal. You would describe that as people are logging on to an online gaming platform called Twitch and making money. Or logging on to Twitch and building relationships with people halfway across the world that they'll never see face to face. Right? That's a signal. Okay, here's a couple other signals. IBM is offering $200,000 to developers to create tech solutions for natural disaster relief. Right? So again, you're reading the paper in the morning. You see that, you jot that down. That's kind of an interesting signal. What does that mean? Because it's not just that IBM's offering $200,000. IBM's actually doing something very novel. They're crowdsourcing solutions to major problems. Problems that were typically dealt with by government agencies or research organizations or kind of local entities or NGOs now are being developed by people like you and me. So we call it crowdsourcing. There's another company, I don't have it up here, it was, I think it was Mount Sinai in New York, big hospital, convention, big gathering research around of cardiologists. So cardiologists sitting around a room trying to figure out this problem with blood flow in the heart. Couldn't figure it out. They hired a team of gamers to come in and gamify the heart. We're trying to get blood to flow from here to here, and all the best minds in cardiology could not figure it out, and a team of gamers figured it out in about 45 minutes. Well, you just got to do this. Well, no, you got to watch out for that. I mean, they were attuned to this. It's kind of because they gamified it. You know, all these cardiologists, I mean, you can see this. There's stories about it, books written about this case. All these cardiologists kind of scratching their heads going, oh, yeah, I thought about that, right? Not medical experts, just 15-year-old kids who play games came in. Major medical breakthroughs. Amazon bought Whole Foods. That's big. It's real big. So if I'm trying to control the world, I want to control retail, supply chain, goods and services, food, healthcare, right? And again, it's not nefarious. I'm just telling you, that's kind of what's going on right now. AI is being used to generate virtual jokes. An NBA team uses virtual reality to evaluate players at the draft combine. So they're now using VR tools to evaluate players. Companies are saying they no longer show preferences for a bachelor's degree. It's happening. A lot of companies out there. I don't think they're actually doing anything about it, but they are saying that, right? Walmart and Volkswagen partnered up on a nationwide electric car, building nationwide electric car stations. Okay? You see where we're going with this? So you gotta kind of know what these are. But you have to do something with this. So this is where the combinatorial forecasting exercise comes in. And you're gonna do this sitting at your tables. Alright? Do you have paper, by the way? Usually we have, I was expecting for there to be the little conference pads. Okay. So you're gonna take out the paper. Now here's what this is. So anyone know what this is? Platypus. Evolutionary concept, right? It's kind of a bunch of things all combined into one. So you can imagine combinatorial forecasting, again, it's an evolutionary process that's basically the act of combining signals to come up with one possibility. Okay, let me show you an example of this. So in 1993, if you're Sony, you are really scared. If you are whoever made those JVC, those god-awful video cameras, remember those? The ones you kind of hold up here, you had a big duffel bag. Your world was actually not near as secure as you might have thought it was at that time. Why? Because these technologies, anyone familiar with the concept of jobs to be done, kind of comes from Clayton Christensen, kind of a Harvard business theory, but he talks about this idea that consumers actually hire you to do a job for them. So the example that we often use is, so I love coffee. I haven't had a cup. I'm going to find one after this, right? But I love coffee. I don't actually want to own a coffee maker. I want a warm cup of coffee in the morning. Does this make sense? So if I can find something that gives me because the job I'm hiring that coffee maker to do is make me a warm cup of coffee. The warm cup of coffee is the prize, not the coffee maker, the big plastic clunky thing sitting on my counter. Right? And if I can find a way to get rid of that thing and still have a cup of coffee, I'm all in. Does that make sense? So then this is kind of where this comes. So again, I don't want to own all those different things. Right? I want what those do for me, but if there's a better option, I'm in. Right? So companies like Apple, Steve Jobs, actually, and everyone talks about Steve Jobs, a little cliche at this point, but actually was a pretty smart guy, would have been terrible to work for, but kind of clued into this. So Apple, companies like that, they're looking at this little array of gadgetry and saying, oh, no, there's got to be a way that you could combine these. Like if you took the phone and you could probably put like some sort of micro, you know, like a chip on it that could store music, and then you could probably turn that into like a Walkman type of device. And you know what I bet you could do? I bet you could embed some sort of calendar function on it, get rid of these big clunky PDAs. Did you ever have one of those? I used to have one of those big, right, and you're silly and you're kind of So this is the idea, right? So in 1993, these would have been 7 or 8 signals sitting in front of you. And you want to now decide, create the platypus, what would happen if all those signals got together and had a baby, basically. Make sense? All right, and this is what it looks like. So what you're going to do is at your table, I want you to brainstorm at least one, but no more than like 3 signals, just given the time we have. Usually I do this over the course of a whole day. signals, things that you're seeing out there. And then once you do that, as a table, you're going to take three of those signals and you're going to combine them. So pick the three best signals, the ones that you think are kind of the most provocative. If all three of those signals came together, what new possibility would it create? Does this make sense? Let me show you an example real quick so you know. Okay, so let's take the IBM is offering money to developers to create tech. NBA teams are using virtual reality to evaluate players at a draft. And here's another one. A 24-year-old is hitchhiking across America and live streaming the whole thing on Twitch. Three completely separate things, but hits, things that we notice. What would the possibility be? Well, you could imagine a possibility where tech companies bid to hire college grads whose abilities show promise for combating climate change. Now, this is a little dense. Again, usually I do this over the course of a while. You got to let this kind of seep in a little bit. But imagine if all three of these signals got together, what new possibility would it arouse, right? So another one I sometimes think about is like Uber. People are now hailing cabs using a smartphone. Amazon bought Whole Foods. And, now community college is free. Okay, if I took those three possibilities, I might be able to say that a new educational model could emerge that was free and integrated transportation and food to help learners become more successful. Does that make sense? No right or wrong answer here, but have some fun with this. Do this at your table. We're going to have to go a little bit quick, so please move quickly. No long preaching sermons, just kind of real quick, like here's my signal, here's what I think, and try to bring those together into a new possibility. Okay, so let's go ahead and bring it back. Again, I really, really hate to rush you because there's such a richness to this exercise. Consider this kind of train the trainer, and then you can go back and do a 4-day long conference at your institution on combinatorial forecasting, and I promise you people will get really jazzed about this. One quick thing to note, so a couple of institutions, we do not currently do this, but a couple of institutions have actually turned signal collecting and combinatorial forecasting into a student-run exercise. So what you do is you actually get students to start collecting and amassing signals and coming up with new and future possibilities. So Davidson College in North Carolina has been doing this. I've been kind of helping a couple of their folks sort of think through what this is. Some real close friends that work there. I also, and I don't know if I had mentioned before, I used to teach at Gordon College in the North Shore, so Massachusetts. So I've been helping some of my friends there, and they're actually going to start doing this with students, where get students together, and it's fun. It's kind of a jam session, open mic night kind of thing. Really a lot of fun, and I guarantee you it'll energize your people like no one's business. It is so exciting. And then you get people really kind of excited. And again, we're shaping the future, right? We're not just sitting back and saying, well, we can't shape. But at the same time, because I always got to keep my, keep the doomsdayers in view, right? You're shaping your future because you have to, right? Because it's a dark and scary world out there. And if you're not leaning in and engaging this stuff, someone's going to shape it for you. So who feels like they've got a good example of a possibility? And again, I know you went through this quickly. Yes.
So that's the first indicator that we're looking at. So that changes the whole dynamics of what they're making and what they're selling, and it changes the dynamics of the product. And so now the product going into mid-21st century and beyond, it's become more automated, almost self-driving. So that changes the technology and the electronics. So looking at the parking assist, the lane change out of your lane, automated braking, the whole technological is the second signal that we looked at. And then the third signal is looking at the ability to be more creative and competitive as each of the big three, so-called big three, Chrysler, Ford, and GM, as they are competing with one another since they're all getting out of the small car. the SUV industry as a, how do we move our car one more above the other one, and then how do we find those creative individuals to redesign and re-engineer the product to be more marketable to the overall consumer. So our new possibility, looking at higher education, is to come up with degree programs, which you call GPS Aviators.
Yes.
GPS
Aviators. I love it.
And so what we're looking at, our new possibility, is to be able to use your term to create bidding wars within the automotive industry where individuals are looking for our graduates to be GPS aviators that will be able to come in and redesign the technological advantages of almost automated vehicles.
Wow. Bravo. Awesome. Very good. So you might want to trademark that, because I think there's a lot of like really smart driven people in the room right now, so they may go after that. So you might want to get your handle on that. All right. So you see what? So now all of a sudden we're thinking about a whole new set of possibilities, right? That actually is a very rich concept, right? Then you start thinking about, well, what would it take to turn that into maybe some sort of student facing tool enabled by artificial intelligence to allow it to move quickly? Lots of possibilities there, right? That's good. That's a good one. And what I like about that, and this is another piece that I think we often have to keep in mind, is the need for cross-industry insights. So I spend a lot of time in higher ed, and I can tell you right now, we actually don't know near as much as we think we do. Industries have undergone massive upheaval and change for several decades now, and we have a lot to learn. So, for example, there's a reason why the Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Teaching and Learning is now adopting healthcare transformation practices for education. So what they call the rise of the improvement sciences, which is a big area, a big field, very important. How do organizations not just change but actually improve? They're piping in a lot of those insights from healthcare models and transformational models around things like patient-centered medical care. There are paradigms and frameworks out there for us to learn from. So to that point of saying, you know what, I don't really know what the industry in terms of education is dealing with. I can tell you right now, innovation in higher education is a pretty low bar to begin with. I'm sorry. There's actually much more exciting things happening outside of our industry. And increasingly, again, omni-channel consumption, I don't think our learners really care, right? I think that they're looking for a unified experience that allows them to get from point A to point B as quickly and as seamlessly, as cost-effective as possible, right? So again, we have to kind of be thinking in that kind of cross-industry perspective. Okay, let's have one more. Good signals. That's a good one. That's a tough one to follow. Any other just signals? Like anyone just have a signal? Maybe you didn't come up with a possibility yet?
Lots of, I mean, urbanization of America, what's going on in cities, all these trains and where's the
Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
Because I'm not sure that that's really taking into account history. It's not really about the future. Also, we're trying to solve problems that exist in 100 years.
Yeah. So that's an example. So mass urbanization or shifts in urban. Other signals? Ah, discount airlines. Okay. Yeah. So if we took mass urbanization, so the way you would often really describe that is people are moving out of the suburbs and back into the city. Like that's literally, that's all you say. Do not make it sound fancy. It's not an academic statement. Just say, you know what? People are moving. People used to live in, you know, suburban, and now they're living in the city. And there are discount airlines out there that are offering really cheap fares for a relatively subpar experience, right? Is that, I mean, that's kind of the idea, right? All right. If though, sorry, I've got scars. If those two came together, let's say the people that are building all these urban and the airline folks got together in a hotel like this and had a discussion, what do you think they might come up with? What's that?
A tunnel?
Yeah. Yeah? There you go. So we're, and so now think, okay, so we've got housing and aviation. Another way that you can do this that works really well is sometimes you get really focused on the signal, you forget the big picture. Okay, really what we're talking about is, and just, you know, innovation, fill in the blank. We're talking about innovation in aviation versus innovation in housing. They get together, what's the possibility? So again, I do want to warn you as you do this, sometimes you can make this too hard for yourself. So don't get so hung up, and this is the tricky part, don't get so hung up at the end of the day on the actual signal. It's really about crafting the possibility. Does that make sense? So what's another kind of tactic that you can employ to really make this possible? Okay, does this make sense so far? Okay, I literally have 2 minutes, so I'm going to show you one more thing. This is just kind of a next step for how you might do this. Now, I wanted to just show you this briefly, though. So you may ask, well, institutions that do this work, what kinds of things do they end up coming up with? What types of things do they want to do? So this is the product of this work being implemented at SNHU for about 5 years now. So about 5 years from 5 years now, in some variety, we've been doing future-proofing, foresight, strategy, and forecasting. And these are the conclusions that we reached in our most recent strategic plan. As we look out to the future, we're going to have to rely on these methods increasingly more than we do. So rather than just developing strategies, in fact, we told NEASC, our accreditor, recently that we're not even sure it makes sense for us to have a strategic plan in the future. The world's changing too quickly. You want a strategic plan, why? What am I going to do? It's going to change in 6 months, right? And they're open to that, right? So it's interesting. It's interesting conversations, right? Employing digital talent, using what we call synthetic colleagues to solve some of our biggest challenges. There is no reason why in a meeting, your forecasting and your modeling, you should be using AI and really progressive tools to accelerate the pace of innovation, to really think about the collective expertise that you can be using. Imagine Alexa around the table while you're doing strategic planning. This is what we're doing now. So we're using these tools to accelerate the process of decision making. And what we call willful disruption. We will conduct deliberate experimentation to put ourselves out of business, because if we don't, somebody else will. So we recently acquired a company called LRNG, which does kind of community-based learning, face-to-face learning, and in a manner that might be said to compete with existing online education programs. We do that on purpose, right? Because if we're not putting ourselves out of business, someone else will. So you have to be willing to be disruptive. Now, again, don't be a jerk about it, right? But you've got to be willing to push the envelope. You've got to be willing to say, you know what, we're doing this today. This may not actually be the business we're in. May not be the business we want to be in. What are the ways in which we can continue to push ourselves to innovate and to advance? And so this is kind of what we've done. These are the ways in which we've implemented some of this stuff. So what could you do as you kind of leave here? And this is a lot here, but I just want to kind of leave you with this. Don't lose sight of the problem. What's the problem statement? What's your institution dealing with? And what's the real problem? Develop a process for engaging in foresight strategy. I don't know what that looks like for your different institutions, if that's bringing, you know, doing a board meeting and kind of disseminating this information, if it's having students collect signals, if it's doing something through some sort of community learning or collaborative learning type of format. And at the end of the day, get down to business, because I will tell you right now, the clock is ticking. The sense of urgency for our institutions not to change, I do not like the notion of change, I like the notion of improvement. Our institutions have to improve. We've got to get better at what we do, because it's an important mandate. So that's all I got. Thank you all so much. Tons of fun. Happy to continue the conversation in any way you need. Thanks.